might get me back on track. I tried to keep Arthur happy, but he didn't like this new alliance of me and Hazel. I was nothing without him. He'd made that clear enough. And I knew that if I were found out, he'd do nothing to protect me. I'd be taken off to jail, right behind Mr. Rosenberg. I heard low voices, Arthur's and then another man's. With one of the spies in our network arrested, the plan had been thrown into disarray. As the afternoon sun over Croton on Hudson crawled westward, panic began to set in. What if they kept me here? Or sent me away? I had to be back in the city by tonight's performance. With only 4 more shows left before opening night, each one was an opportunity to fine-tune the role. No way would an understudy be able to cover for me, as they usually only got their own rehearsals once the show was up and running. I couldn't jeopardize the show. I couldn't do that to Hazel, after everything she'd done for me. More voices. Jumping off the bed, I put my ear to the door when it suddenly opened. Arthur glowered at me and motioned for me to follow him. In the kitchen, a woman was making bologna sandwiches with white bread and offered me one. I was starving at that point, having forgotten to eat breakfast before rehearsal, and accepted the plate and a seat at the wobbly Formica table. A severe-looking man, with black hair so thick it looked like a wig, sat across from me, chewing on his own sandwich. He nodded at me solemnly. Arthur leaned against the kitchen counter, arms crossed. I knew better than to ask their names, this mysterious couple. They appeared to be siblings. The woman's profile mirrored the man's, and she had a similar low hairline, although her hair was pulled back in a tight bun. I glanced over at Arthur, trying to get a read on his mood. He was hunched over and scratched at a patch of skin under his short-sleeved button-down shirt, the one I'd bought for him back in Los Angeles, attracted to its needle-thin lines of turquoise. He seemed cowed, childlike. This new subservience chilled me. Arthur had trained at the School of Special Assignment in Russia. For a year, he'd taken 6 courses a day in the basics of being a handler. He'd passed many of these skills on to me, like how to break a tail or work a meat, but he also knew how to kill silently and quickly. He was all-powerful, or so I'd thought. But clearly, these 2 comrades were much higher up in the organization. He saw me looking at him and stopped scratching.
"What does the organization suggest we do?"
Arthur addressed the man and woman equally. The man put down his sandwich and wiped his mouth with a paper napkin.
"We need to get you both away from here. It's too hot."
"Gold and Greenglass have been passing secrets since 45, said Arthur. I recognized both names, agents who'd been caught in the FBI's sting. Julius since 1942. They should have been phased out. We brought this on ourselves.
The information they retrieved has been invaluable, said the man. Until now, the benefits have outweighed the risks.
Do you think Julius will talk? Asked Arthur.
The woman didn't give a direct answer. He's been working for us for a while, which means he's accumulated valuable knowledge. She snapped her head in my direction. How is it going with the play?
Fill them in on what you've told me, directed Arthur. I tried to hide the worry in my voice.
The play's going well, and people are coming to the previews, in spite of the fact that Hazel had to testify. Arthur spoke up.
The play's excellent, and Maxine stands out. It's exactly what we hoped for. Everyone's already talking about it, and it hasn't even opened.
When is opening night? The woman asked. Friday. All right.
after the reviews are out, come up with a reason to quit. We'll relocate you both to California. My heart sank. But I'm under contract for the next 4 months. It's too dangerous for you to stick around New York, not with what's going on with Rosenberg. The thought of leaving the play made me sick. I didn't realize until now how hard it would be to relocate again and leave behind the friends I'd made. To leave Hazel behind. The press will be terrible if I suddenly up and quit. No one wants to hire an actress who cuts out on her contract. The woman stared at me. I'm sure it happens all the time.
Maxine's up for another film role. Right, Maxine?
Arthur nodded at me. Tell them about it. It was true. A Hollywood director had seen an early preview of the play and set up a meeting soon after, gushing that I'd be perfect for the female lead in his next movie. I tried not to get too excited about it. After all, I'd been burned last time this happened. It's a possible part in the new James Mason film, I offered.
The female lead, said Arthur. The perfect excuse to get her out of New York.
If it works out, the woman reminded them. We've been down that road before, unsuccessfully. What if she blows it again? Arthur didn't answer right off, letting the moment hang.
I've been thinking about it, and there might be another way, if she doesn't get the role. One that would create a diversion from Julius, as well as close the show down entirely.
This was news to me. The woman narrowed her eyes. What's that?
Charlie Butterfield.
Arthur practically growled the name.
Who's Charlie Butterfield?
Asked the man.
He works with American Business Consultants and has been assigned to monitor Hazel Ripley to make sure she stays patriotic. His father is Lawrence Butterfield, the one stirring up all the fuss in New York. Charlie's by Hazel's side constantly.
Arthur gave me a pointed look.
We saw them together at Coney Island. I got the impression he's in love with her.
I wish Arthur weren't so astute. I'd picked up the same dynamic between them, but hoped Arthur hadn't noticed. Recently, during rehearsals, Hazel and Charlie had behaved like a couple of turtle doves, practically cooing to each other when they thought no one was looking.
What do you think is going on? Asked the woman. Is she stringing him along in order to get his father off her back? Or is it more than that?
Arthur looked to me to answer the question. I'm not sure, I said.
Either way, the situation could be a valuable tool for us, said the woman.
The conversation was not going the way I'd expected. Even though it wasn't what I wanted, ultimately, I didn't care if they dragged me away from the play, as long as they didn't ruin Hazel's life as well. God knew what they were thinking, but it wouldn't be good for Hazel or Charlie.
Maxine, is something wrong?
The man eyed me suspiciously. I swallowed.
I'm sorry. It's just that I'm opening a play in 3 days. I know you want the reviews to be raves, and it's a big role. Let's just focus on that for now, all right?
The man picked up his plate and tossed it into the sink. The sound of it shattering echoed in the tight room. No one moved.
Your first priority is the party. You seem to be forgetting that fact, Miss Mead.
No, I'm not at all. My denial sounded thin, even to me. I'm simply trying to do what you've asked of me. Arthur pointed a finger in my face.
I'm not sure where you stand anymore. You and Hazel are joined at the hip these days. I don't like it.
Really, Arthur, said the woman, first Caroline, now Maxine. Your track record with your agents is certainly problematic. I sat frozen in place, digesting this piece of information. I'd figured Arthur's wife's illness had developed out of the stress of being an agent. Not everyone was cut out for the job, and her psychological weakness certainly fed my own ego. But had she in fact turned on the party? Questioned her role? Was she mad? Or had she been silenced? The woman went to the sink, picked up the broken plate pieces, and threw them in a garbage can. When she was done, she brushed her hands together. I got the impression that she was the toughest of the three, her face pinched and mean. "You've done so much for us already, Miss Mead," she said the words without a hint of gratitude. "We are all indebted to your support and good work over the many years. So many years. Perhaps once this is all over, you deserve a reward, not a punishment." Arthur's eyebrows raised. She continued, "A journey to the Soviet Union, where you will be lauded and heralded and can continue your good work for us. We should have done so with Julius, but we left it too late. We ought to learn from our mistakes." They all observed me for my reaction to this glorious invitation. Go to Russia, a country I'd never been to and whose language I didn't speak. This was a warning wrapped up in a big pink ribbon. The bologna sandwich in my stomach threatened to come back up. I coughed, covering my mouth as I did so, trying to rearrange my expression into something unreadable. I was an actress, after all. This was what I did for a living. But with someone else's words. I didn't usually have to be playwright, director, and actress on the spot. I had to respond appropriately. Make them believe me. So I drew on a tried-and-true theater technique, sense memory. I thought back to a time when I was happy as a child, when I felt safe. My grandmother and I used to pick mushrooms on the shores of a lake near our house. We'd come home and sauté them in butter, and the crunch and savory flavor of the dish made me swoon with delight. I could practically taste the mushroom on my tongue, and, like magic, a peaceful calm swept over me. I raised my head up high and let my shoulders fall. I would be thrilled to accept such an honor. The woman seemed flustered. You would? Of course. The words came out strong and sure, confident. The party has been my family for many years now, and I'm here to do whatever you need, in whatever capacity you require. Good. That's what I like to hear. I silently gave thanks for my profession. Still, I like this idea of a distracting scandal. If we haven't heard back about the movie by Friday, let's use it to our advantage. That's exactly what I was thinking. Arthur straightened, eager to prove his own loyalty. We set up Charlie Butterfield and Hazel Ripley in a compromising position. No doubt Maxine can pull that off. And expose the fact that Butterfield's son is sleeping with an accused communist who's written a play that the feds hate. The press will go mad at their hypocrisy, particularly if the show's a big hit. And no doubt the show would close. Hazel would lose everything, her name, her livelihood. The woman smiled, pleased. Arthur had redeemed himself. Report back through the usual channels. I stayed silent during the long ride back to the city. What had I done?
Chapter 19. Hazel. July 1950. 5 hours to go until opening night. Hazel stared at the gown hanging from her closet door, the one Maxine had insisted she buy during a Bergdorf's shopping spree a couple of weeks ago. It wasn't her usual style, which was a subdued color and cut. This was flashy, more like something Maxine would wear, and she'd tried it on only because Maxine had insisted. Strapless white satin with a tulle overlay that faded from black to pink and scalloped edging. It shouted, "Look at me!" "I simply won't allow you to show up as Hayseed Hazel for your Broadway debut," Maxine had declared. "This dress is perfect for who you are now. Hazel Ripley, director and playwright." Hazel had bought it, happy that it came with a matching tulle shawl. Add long white gloves and she wouldn't feel quite so conspicuous, hopefully. There was nothing more she could do. At this point in the game, her job as writer and director was over. It was up to the cast and crew to pull off the show and then keep on doing it for however long Mr. Canby allowed it to run. Hazel's mother was coming to the show tonight, and she couldn't wait for her to see the marquee with her name in huge red letters, "Wartime Sonata by Hazel Ripley," evidence of her success that was irrefutable, finally. At 5:30, she knocked on Maxine's door, and they caught a cab uptown. Maxine was unusually quiet, but it made perfect sense that she was nervous. Hazel squeezed her hand. "Here goes nothing. Thank you for this chance. You've done so much for me." Maxine looked down at their clasped hands. She also wore white, in a pale floral pattern, like two brides off to be married in a dual wedding. In many ways, it was true. The theater was like a church to both of them, a safe haven from the real world. "Ever since Naples, we've been a team, and a good one at that," said Hazel. "This play wouldn't be nearly as great with Brandy in your role. Thank goodness you came to New York to save the day." "Yes, thank goodness," she echoed. Hazel couldn't stand it any longer. She had to share her news. They'd come so far, from performing on a flatbed truck to mounting a show on a historic Broadway stage, that it seemed a shame to keep her secret on their big night. "There's something I have to confess to you. The one bright spot in all this negative attention on the show." "What's that?" "Charlie and I? We're in love. I'm sorry I didn't tell you sooner, but with the play and rehearsals, we were trying to keep it quiet. I know we seem like a mismatched pair politically, but he's really open-minded."
"Really?"
She tilted her head. "You seem skeptical." Maxine spoke as if she were choosing her words carefully. "He's the son of the big bad Butterfield. Maybe it's smart to stay away from him, at least for the time being." "What do you mean?" "I just think it would be prudent, for now, to stay away from Charlie. You don't want to muddle things." "Charlie's the one thing in my life that's not muddled." Hazel studied her friend. "This is the first time I've truly been in love. I thought you'd be happy for me."
"Of course I'm happy."
Maxine hugged her hard. "Of course." Maxine's obvious reluctance was about more than their superficial mismatch, Hazel was certain. She remembered Floyd's caricatures in Naples. Hazel as the plain Jane and Maxine as the femme fatale. There was no question that Hazel's countenance and carriage had changed with her newfound power, augmented by Charlie's love. She'd finally blossomed. Could Maxine's status as the most beautiful woman in the room be that easily threatened? They separated once they arrived at the theater, Maxine to her dressing room and Hazel into the house, where Mr. Canby was looking over the seating arrangements with the press agent. Opening nights were like high-stakes dinner parties, where certain reviewers required the best seats, others could be placed a little farther back, all while accommodating backers and industry royalty, and hoping that no one left the theater offended before the curtain even lifted. Gossip columnist Walter Winchell needed to be placed far from Dorothy Kilgallen due to a long-standing feud about who knows what, while Brooks Atkinson, the reviewer for The Times, required an aisle seat not too close to the stage but not too far back either. At curtain call, the reviewers would scurry up the aisles before the rest of the audience began filing out in a race to make the late edition deadline. All looked good, and Mr. Canby and the press agent headed to the lobby to finalize the last-minute changes with the box office staff. Charlie passed them, shaking Mr. Canby's hand, and did the same once he reached Hazel. It was torture to not be able to kiss properly. "You look marvelous," he said. "That dress is beautiful, as are you." Charlie looked dashing in his tuxedo. Hazel hated to pull herself away. I should go see the cast and give them a pre-show pep talk. Are you nervous? Right now, I'd rather be anywhere else. Seriously, I have half a mind to run down to the basement and curl up in a ball in the corner. Then you'd ruin your pretty dress, and you don't want to do that, do you? He took her arm. Come with me. He pulled her up the stairs to the balcony, to the very back of the theater. In the shadows, he kissed her, long and slow, before drawing her in front of him and wrapping his arms around her waist. They looked over the rows of seats lined up like velvet soldiers down to the set, where the actors warmed up with stretches and vocal exercises, joking around and teasing one another, all in high spirits. The tensions of opening night had succeeded in finally pulling the company together, in spite of the ongoing blacklist and the various factions that had developed among the cast. For the next 3 hours, the critics served as a common enemy, uniting all sides. After the show, they'd all go to Sardi's, as was expected after an opening, and drink to the show's success, everyone wide-eyed and buzzed from the excitement, as well as the anxiety of waiting for the first reviews. Mr. Canby would meet a messenger on the sidewalk outside the restaurant, get handed a stack of newspapers, and scan through each in search of the theater section. If he entered holding the issues aloft, champagne corks would begin popping. If he tossed them in the trash and came in empty-handed, the party would turn into a wake. Hazel had to enjoy the moment, this moment, because anything could happen. She'd done her very best, and that would sustain her. I should go. Reluctantly, she kissed Charlie before leaving him to gather everyone on the stage to thank them for all their hard work, for believing in her and in the play, and also to express her gratitude to Mr. Canby for giving them the opportunity to present it to the world. Everyone clapped and kissed, but then the stage manager called half hour and the moment passed, as the nerves kicked in and the actors scrambled back to their dressing rooms to finish getting ready. In the house, she greeted her mother, who looked splendid in a pink gown Hazel hadn't seen her wear since before her brother's death. "You look lovely." She kissed Ruth's rouged cheek, pleased to have given her a night out, the first one in a very long time. One of the neighbors was looking after her father that evening. She wished he could have come, to share in her success. Hazel made sure Ruth was settled in and then popped over to where Lavinia sat with several residents from the Chelsea, who offered Hazel kisses and congratulations. Finally, she took her place next to Mr. Canby at the top of the center aisle, greeting the incoming agents, lawyers, and industry people. How far she'd come, from the shadows of understudying where no one really knew she existed, to this. She checked her watch. 10 minutes after 8 o'clock. Not bad for an opening night. The curtain finally lifted, and she relished the collective gasp as the audience took in the set, an intricate replica of a war-torn, formerly majestic hotel, complete with a crystal chandelier, a scarred grand piano, and a pile of rubble stage left. That gasp was a good sign. It meant they would suspend their belief and enter the world of the play easily, happily. The first act moved along fast, buoyed by the actor's nervous energy, but not so fast that the lines got lost. Excellent. At intermission, Hazel and Mr. Canby shared hesitant smiles. So far, so good. The final act began well, but about halfway through, Maxine seemed off. Hazel couldn't put her finger on it, and probably the audience, seeing the play for the first time, didn't notice. But the other actors sensed it and became slightly more careful when they should be diving in, building the emotion and the tension. There was tension, sure, but it wasn't the right kind. Beside her, Mr. Canby straightened up, alarmed. Hazel clenched her fists, willing the cast to keep up the momentum, not lose it. The audience began to cough. Never a good sign. It meant they were getting fidgety, bored. At the crucial moment near the second-to-last scene, Maxine paused. She'd never paused at that place in the script before. She turned out, facing the audience. Her face was frozen, eyes wide. Her lips parted, but no words came out. She'd been thrown into that desperate oblivion, one every actor fears. She'd gone up on her lines. Hazel knew that horrible feeling from her acting classes. She imagined it was similar to a fighter pilot ejecting from a plane. One minute you were the pilot, fully in charge, and the next you were drifting in the open skies, vulnerable, at the mercy of the winds. When Hazel had gone up doing a monologue from Macbeth in acting class, she'd been thrust out of the world of the play, where she portrayed a Scottish noblewoman bent on murder, and was suddenly just Hazel, a plain girl standing all alone on a stage, everyone staring and judging her. Blood had pounded in her temples as adrenaline flooded her body. It had felt unbearable. The audience began to murmur and shift in their seats. Hazel said the line quietly out loud, vainly hoping that somehow Maxine would pick up the cue and get back on track. Tears came to Maxine's eyes, magnified by the lights, but she didn't wipe them away. Maxine stood there, in terror, lost, as the seconds stretched on and on. After what seemed like hours, one of the other actors fed Maxine her line, and the show finally lurched forward. Hazel swore she heard a collective sigh of relief from the audience members, but recovery proved futile. The cast was unnerved, and Maxine overacted the final scene, as if to make up for her misstep. The magic was gone. Maxine's last line rang out over the theater, drifted up to the mezzanine and the top balcony, and dissipated. Where in earlier performances Hazel had heard gasps, sobs even, in the interval between the last line and the first burst of applause, tonight a splatter of limp clapping broke out. It grew louder as the cast assembled on stage for the curtain call, but not by much. Audience members were already scuttling out, turning their backs on the work of these actors who'd slaved so hard the past few months and tried valiantly to bring Hazel's words to life. If only the critics could have come the night before, or on any other night but this one, if only. Without saying a word, Mr. Canby sprinted up the aisle before the curtain call was finished. Hazel sat for a moment, stunned, before slipping out the side door of the house and heading up to Maxine's dressing room. The door was ajar. Hazel pushed it open and stood there, unsure of what to do next. Maxine sat in front of her mirror, wiping off the stage makeup, her shorn hair sticking up as if she'd run her fingers through it in frustration. "Sorry, Hazel, I blew it." The bitterness in her voice brought tears to Hazel's eyes. "You went up on your lines. Happens to everyone at some point." "Not on opening night. At the most crucial moment in the play, you should have never cast me. I was terrible." "What happened?" Hazel knelt down at her friend's side, one hand on her leg and the other on the back of the chair. The touch broke Maxine's fierce defensiveness. Tears fell down her face, streaking her cake foundation. "I forgot one line. Then everything went blank, and then it was like I was paralyzed, frozen in place, which made me panic even more. I'm so sorry."
"It was over before you knew it."
"Do you think so?"
"Of course,"
lied Hazel. Maxine grabbed a tissue and wiped her cheeks. "Hey, the play is strong, so maybe the critics will see beneath my flub what a great script it is."
"Exactly. Don't be too hard on yourself. Think of all those times in Naples we made stuff up because we'd learned the play the day before and were completely lost."
Maxine wiped her eyes.
"We did, didn't we? At one point you did a monologue from George Bernard Shaw to fill the time. The guys loved it. Hey, whatever works. See you at Sardi's?"
"Thanks, doll. Let me get cleaned up, and we'll drink to Naples." Hazel congratulated the cast members she ran into on the stairway, a forced cheer in her voice. Charlie was waiting in the corridor. She craved Charlie's touch, wanted to fall into his embrace and be comforted instead of having to offer comfort, but that wasn't possible in public. He smiled at her and offered a good show, but they both knew it had been a disaster.
"Have you seen Mr. Canby yet?" she asked him.
"No. Probably ran back to his office to calculate how much money he'll lose if we get panned."
"Stop with that. It'll be fine. You'll see."
She couldn't bear it.
"Give me a moment. I should see my mother off in a cab."
She found her in the lobby. Most of the crowd had thinned out, thank goodness.
"My darling, you poor dear."
The words were followed by an awkward hug, but the effect was as if Hazel had been slapped across the face. Her mother was practically giddy. Hazel realized, in a sickening rush, that tonight's debacle was everything her mother had dreamed of. Hazel had failed, miserably and publicly, which meant Ruth could come to the rescue and reinsert herself in her daughter's life. Hazel desperately wished her father could have attended and blunted the bitter impact of her mother's joy. As quickly as possible, she shuttled her mother into a taxi, found Charlie, and together they walked to Sardi's. Charlie didn't say much, but offered his arm, which she gratefully took, happy to feel the connection to him, the strength of his muscles underneath the sleeve of his tuxedo jacket. Inside, the cast stood around the bar, laughing as if everything were normal. Hazel worked her way into the middle of their group, clinked glasses, and wound from one to the next, giving each a nugget of thanks. Same with the crew, from the wardrobe mistress to the stage manager. Maxine finally arrived, Arthur skulking behind her. She looked radiant in her red wig, the bitterness she'd revealed to Hazel in the dressing room replaced with a wide smile and too loud laughter. Hazel's heart went out to her friend. Showing up at the bar tonight and acting happy was sure to be one of the toughest performances she'd ever delivered. A movement outside the window caught Hazel's eye. Mr. Canby. He took a pile of newspapers from a messenger and awkwardly tucked them under one arm as he rooted around in his pocket for some change. The messenger sprinted off as Mr. Canby thumbed to the arts section in the first paper. He scanned it, then tossed it in the trash. Same with the next one. And the next. Hazel slipped out. Charlie was busy chatting with the soundboard operator and didn't notice her leave. Let me read one. Mr. Canby whirled around, his face revealing nothing. These critics know nothing, my dear. Trust me, I've been down this road many times before. Are they that bad? He didn't answer. If you read any of this, the words will be embedded in your head for years to come. You'll sit down to write another play, and this is what you'll think of. I don't want to subject you to that kind of torture. You're a gifted playwright. Go back home tonight and start on your next play.
Hand one over.
He did, finally. She had to see it, had to know what people would be saying about her, thinking about her. The review belittled her attempt, as a woman playwright, to handle a subject as serious as war, although the critic did say several moments in the early scenes held promise. Maxine was taken to task for trying to be a stage actress, when clearly she should stick to movies. Silent ones, preferably. The door opened and Maxine came out, her wrap slung over one shoulder and a hand on her hip, ready for a fight.
Let's have it, then.
Hazel knew better than to soften the blow for Maxine the way Mr. Canby had done for her. All those qualifiers made it worse. Maxine read through it and handed it back. Hazel couldn't read her expression. If anything, she seemed almost relieved. The furrows in her forehead smoothed out as she rearranged her fur stole so it sat evenly on both shoulders. She seemed calm, serene.
"Sorry I blew it for you," Maxine said. "I guess it's all over now."
Not the response she'd expected. Hazel stared at Maxine, confused. She wished Charlie were here so she could get his reaction to Maxine's lack of one. Something was off, and it wasn't just the play. In Naples, Maxine had been the strong one, the unflappable one. It was hard to believe that the opening of a play on Broadway had thrown her. Even in rehearsal, when she forgot a line, she'd blithely play through it until she found her way. Until opening night. But the pressure had been enormous on both of them.
"They didn't like either of us, so you didn't blow it alone," offered Hazel. "They'd probably have hated the play, no matter how splendidly you performed the role."
"We can't control the critics."
Mr. Canby balled up the last newspaper and tossed it into a nearby trash can.
"I'm glad I took the risk on you both, and I don't regret a thing."
"Do you think word of mouth might make up for the reviews?"
Hazel knew she came off as desperate, but had to ask.
"Not in July. Sorry, kid."
Maxine rejoined the party, but Hazel wanted to get home. Charlie insisted on coming up, and as she sat on the sofa, her head resting on his shoulder, staring out into the night sky, she was glad he had.
"Well, that's that, then," she sighed. "My show was a bust."
So was Arthur Miller's Broadway debut. The man who had all the luck closed after four performances. "You're in good company." She had to laugh.
"How do you know that?"
"Because I went to the last performance."
"I like the way you think."
"Look, I know right now the bad reviews sting, but I have no doubt that you will write another play and get it up on Broadway, just like Miller. In the meantime, I'll take care of you. He cleared his throat. I have some news.
What's that?
I got my conditional letter of acceptance. They said my test scores were through the roof, which means with time I might get a shot at the Soviet espionage squad. It's about as far from American business consultants as you can get. No more bungling amateurs. This is the real deal.
She blinked. You mean you're joining the FBI?
Yes. It's what I've been waiting for.
His enthusiasm stunned her.
You should turn it down.
What? I can't do that.
Can't or won't? Stop trying to impress your father, running around after spies that don't exist.
He drew back, defensive. We've been over this, Hazel. They do exist. That's been proven. Just look at Julius Rosenberg. Sure, the HUAC is barking up the wrong tree, going after actors and writers, but our country's secrets are being stolen. If more get into the hands of the Soviets, we'll be in big trouble. We're already in deep trouble, to be perfectly honest. Don't you want someone like me on the inside? Someone who sees the big picture? By going after the actual spies, I can put a stop to this insane focus on entertainers.
A primal anger surged through her. She had to protect herself. Everyone was a suspect. Anyone might betray her, including Charlie.
Maxine had been right. You're not on my side. If you were, you'd walk away from your job and your father now, this very moment.
Look, we're both under a great deal of pressure. You're pushing me away because you're scared, but you don't have to do that. Let things unfold as they will. I promise you, it will all work out.
What makes you think we could be together once you're in the FBI? Federal agents aren't allowed to be with blacklisted actors.
Maybe not at first, sure, but I promise you this witch hunt will pass over.
In what? 1 year? 5? 10?
I can't believe I almost bought into your story. If you really love me, you'll tell me right now that you'll turn it down.
He pulled away.
I can't. I'm sorry.
Then you should go.
He tried once more to convince her, but the words meant nothing. She sat, arms and legs crossed, fuming, until the door clicked softly shut. Then she burst into tears. She walked over to the living room window and wept, letting the sounds and smells of New York wash over her through the open window, a reminder that she was just one of many who'd tried and failed, who'd been decimated by the city.
Chapter 20. Maxine. July 22nd, 1950. After getting the bad news from Mr. Canby and Hazel, I rejoined what was left of the cast party. Arthur hovered behind me, trailing me wherever I went, and I purposely ignored him and flirted with others, laughing too loudly and letting my hand linger too long on the stage manager's arm. I took whatever champagne was offered and downed it fast, knowing that it was the only way to blunt what was ahead. Let's go. Arthur at least let me bid goodbye to the group before yanking me out into the street and gripping my arm hard as we waited for a cab to pull over. When one finally did, he opened the door and shoved me inside, to the point that a man walking by called out, "Hey, that's no way to treat a lady." Arthur ignored him, went around to the other side, and directed the cabbie uptown. I'd hoped he'd wait until we got wherever we were headed to start in on me, but his anger boiled over, fueled by our close proximity.
"You threw it. On purpose."
"No, Arthur. I went up on my lines. It happens to actors all the time. I was too rattled by that meeting up in Westchester. All the menacing talk. I'm an artist and can't be handled like that." He slammed his hand into the side of my face, palm out, so that my head hit the window hard and bounced off. Everything went dark for a couple of seconds, and I wondered if my neck would still hold up the boulder that had been my brain. The thick loopiness of shock was quickly replaced by searing pain that brought me out of my champagne buzz fast. The taxicab driver glanced at me from the rearview mirror, then looked away,
eyes on the road. No one was going to save me now. We headed into Central Park, along the winding road that ran parallel to Fifth Avenue. I knew better than to ask where we were going. The blow had calmed Arthur, temporarily at least, and I didn't want to risk another smack. I gingerly rubbed my head and tried to come up with a plan. Nothing. The first act of the play had gone beautifully, just as we'd rehearsed, which made what I had to do even harder. Earlier, when everyone was milling around, warming up on stage, I spotted Arthur, who'd stopped by to deliver a dozen anemic roses, staring at Hazel like a wolf. He asked me if I'd heard about the movie role, and I'd had to admit there was still no news. "Any day now, I'm sure," I said, but he just shook his head. Right then, I'd realized that the only way to save Hazel from Arthur's scheme was to tank the play. Short term, it would be painful. The thought made me ill, but less so than initiating the scandal they'd cooked up to divert the press's attention from the arrest of Julius Rosenberg. If Hazel and Charlie's relationship came to light, if Hazel was discovered sleeping with the enemy, she'd be attacked by both sides, the theater community as well as the militant right. She'd never write, never work again. At least this way, I'd get the heap of blame. I would be the flighty Hollywood star who blew it, big time. While the reviews would be scathing toward me, Hazel would eventually go on to write another play. I could then hightail it back to California to mourn the fact that I'd thrown away the best role of my life. When the moment came, I'd stopped short, looked out into the audience, and let my eyes go wide in the most sublime imitation of an actor forgetting her lines ever performed. Meanwhile, the words went around and around in my head. If not for Matthew, I'd be dead, part of the rubble, never remembered even by those who hate me. I said them silently in my head, 3, 4 times. The audience stirred, murmured, the pressure building. It was as excruciating for me as it was for them. I fought against every good instinct I had to keep going, to say anything at all, to cross the stage and sit in a chair, anything, anything but stand there like a fool. Another actor eventually came to my rescue and said my line for me. From there, everything and everyone slid downhill, fast. We staggered along aimlessly until the curtain finally fell. If Hazel had been a painter instead of a playwright, it was as if I'd slashed her best artwork with a surgeon's scalpel. Before tonight, I desperately wanted to show everyone what a star I am, prove how perfect I was for this role. It wasn't easy to let go of my own ego, but I had to. I had to in order to save a friend, all while destroying what she believed in most. I had my reasons. That's what I kept telling myself. I'd succeeded in tanking the play and, in doing so, saved Hazel and Charlie from the party's clutches. They were of no value anymore. A twisted triumph.
Pull over here. Arthur threw some bills at the driver as I stepped out. We were just north of the boat pond in the very heart of the park. During daylight hours, the area would be rife with tourists and city dwellers out enjoying the shade of the giant sycamore trees. This late, the place was empty, silent. No one would hear me out here. He dragged me along a dirt path. The hilly area was called the Ramble, where pathways curved in, around, and across each other, winding over a hill covered with shrubs and trees, and back down the other way past a gurgling waterfall. During the day, it was like a maze, where you couldn't tell which way was east or west due to the dense greenery.
In the dead of night, the place was frightening. I tried to keep my sense of direction. We passed no one. We ended up standing on a rocky outcropping overlooking a small inlet. He shoved me down, and my knees banged hard on the stone. To think that this boulder had existed in this same spot for thousands and thousands of years, long before humans, long before the Soviet Union or the United States even existed. Small glints of light shone up from the surface of the rock, and for some reason, their beauty almost brought me to tears.
"Why did you do that?" asked Arthur.
"I didn't do anything." My words came out as a whimper.
"You're useless to us now. You'll never be a star after that. They'll kill you, and me.
Everything is closing in, and you chose this moment to protect your friend.
Don't think I don't know it. And they will too. They're not dumb, Magnilt."
Magnilt. The name I was given as a child. What my grandmother used to call me. He kicked me hard in the upper thigh. I rolled over and gripped it with both hands. "Stop! I don't deserve this! Please, Arthur!" He stood over me, panting, both hands on his hips.
"You do deserve it, traitor!"
"We love each other!" The words made me sick, but I said them anyway, anything to buy some time. "You can't let them tear us apart like this. We're more than the party. Let's break away, together."
"You're saying you want out? Is that what kind of comrade you are? What about everyone who supported you on your way up to the top? Do you think you would have attained your success without us backing you? You belong to us, to me. Don't forget it."
I didn't care. I'd saved Hazel. That was all that mattered. "It's no good anymore. The party's not the same. We're all under fire." Arthur knelt down on one knee, like he was about to propose.
"You've lost your way, Magnilt. You have been pretending all this time, haven't you?"
"No, but we don't know what it's really like in Russia. I don't want to go there. I want my freedom." In response, he grabbed me by the neck and choked me. I tried to punch him, but he was too big, too strong. I grabbed at the hands around my neck and tried in vain to pull them off. Finally, I let go and stared up at the stars beyond his red face, at the way the trees gently brushed the dark sky with their leaves until the sound of the wind was replaced by the pounding of blood in my ears, and I passed out. Arthur left me on that rock in the middle of the night. I came to, briefly, and then fell asleep, too sore to move. I let the humid air, which smelled of rotting wood and wet dirt, drift over me like a ghost, moving in and out of dreams and the sleep of the exhausted. I woke just as orange streaks began to burnish the sky. I tested my bones for damage. Nothing I couldn't handle. Nothing broken. After making my way down to the side of the lake, I splashed water on my face like a vagrant. Two ducks watched me from a distance, curious but wary. I caught a cab at Fifth Avenue and told the driver to take me back to the Chelsea Hotel. Luckily, I still had my purse and my wallet. The driver eyed me in the rearview mirror. I probably looked like a whore who'd been tumbled hard, which pretty much summed me up. I'd whored myself out to Arthur, to the party. They'd groomed me from when I was a teenager and didn't know how to say no, or how to assess what was being asked of me. As I grew older and realized the world wasn't as black and white as they depicted it, I tried hard to justify my role in their master plan to spread communism to the states, but it became more and more difficult. All capitalists weren't awful, nor were all communists morally superior. Working on Broadway with Hazel had opened my eyes to another choice, a world where I could simply act, stripped of any ulterior motives, and deepen my focus on my craft. Because that's where my sympathies lay now, with the artists, the ones who struggled to make sense of the world. That's what I wanted to be. What to do now? I could turn myself in, tell the feds everything I knew, which wasn't much. As an underground operative, I was only told bits and pieces of the puzzle, never the entire thing. I didn't even know the names of the couple I'd met up in Croton. It would make news, sure. The feds would parade me about, just like they did Julius, in handcuffs on the front page. I thought of my grandmother. In her letters, she'd told me how my fame had brought with it not only the check I sent along each month, which she said made her cry whenever she received it, but also the approbation of the people who'd once reviled her. She'd found acceptance, having a well-known actress as a granddaughter, but they would turn on her like a pack of dogs if I outed myself. She'd be persecuted, isolated, and shunned once again. I concealed the fingerprints around my neck with makeup and made it to the theater for the matinee. Before the curtain went up, we were informed that tomorrow's matinee would be the final performance, to no one's surprise. On stage, it was obvious the bad reviews had infected the audience's response, which was remarkably different from previews. Where there had once been guffaws, now there was silence. Hardly a sniff during the big scene where Matthew and I reunite. They'd been told what to think and weren't going to let anything going on stage change their puny minds. While we started with great gusto, the lack of energy from the people staring back at us couldn't help but dampen the performance. Where 2 days ago, bolts of emotional electricity sizzled, this afternoon's show felt more like a funeral for a distant aunt who hadn't left you any money. A muffled misery that's soon forgotten. Back at the hotel after the evening's performance, I crawled into bed and fell into a deep sleep. The phone woke me up Sunday morning. It's me. Arthur. His baritone brought all the aches and fears racing back. Yes? I wasn't sure why he'd called here. Knowing that the phones were tapped, it had to be important. He spoke carefully, measuring out each word. I hope you're feeling better.
I am.
That's good to know. We're going forward, as planned, creating a diversion for our friend. Let us know a good time and place for a rendezvous. Meaning, a time when I'd know that Charlie and Hazel would be together in a compromising position. They were going forward with the plan anyway. No, I scrambled for the right words. There's no point. No point in doing that. That's not your decision. If you don't agree, I've been told to give our regards to your grandmother back in Seattle. We'll be sure to reach out to say hello from you. I let out a weak moan. Arthur knew my deepest vulnerability and would have no problems giving orders to hurt my grandmother if I didn't do what they wanted. Hazel and I shared a cab back to the Chelsea Hotel after the final show, after the maudlin goodbyes and promises to stay in touch. She insisted we meet up on the roof for a final toast, and I agreed, eager for anything to dull the pain. How are you doing? Hazel asked, once we'd settled into our usual places. I should ask that of you. I'm fine. She laughed when I looked askance. I guess I'm fine. I mean, I'm still breathing. Is there anything I can do? Funny how when things are really, really bad, you look around and appreciate the tiny things, like the taste of this wine, you by my side,
because the big picture is so scary that the small things are what keep you grounded. She smiled softly. Who knows? Maybe eventually I'll write another play, one that's even better, even if that seems impossible in the moment. It's strange, but whenever I'm stuck, I come up here and stare out at the city, and before I know it, I'm back on track. Something about this place is magical in that way.
It's your muse.
You're my muse. No, don't shake your head. It was your boldness on the USO tour that inspired me from the very beginning. The way you handled the other girls, the soldiers, the officers. How you're not afraid to jump into the thick of things without overthinking matters or being nervous about screwing up. I haven't forgotten you're the reason why I landed the director's job in the first place. That would have never happened without you sitting at the table, pushing Mr. Canby, pushing me. And it was my dream job. So thank you. It was like a punch in my gut to hear those words. Not anymore. No way. I can't be bringing you down like I did. You're on your own from here, chum. Please, don't be hard on yourself. I hated that she was worried about me and looked away, studying the reflection of the setting sun on the skyline as the gray facades of the neighboring buildings turned a shimmering pink. Hazel stared hard at me. What's that on your face? Without thinking, I had tucked my hair behind my ear, exposing the bruise. I quickly covered my cheek with my hand. Nothing, just some reaction to that awful stage makeup. Let me see. She reached out and gently cupped my chin, her touch so tender I wanted to weep. Is that from Arthur? Did he hit you? There was no point in lying. We got into a tiff. Nothing major. I fell while we were arguing. Hazel wasn't having any of it. No, you're lying. What happened? I tried again. He saw me flirting at the opening night party. It was my fault. I'd had too much to drink. And so he hit you? He didn't mean to, I swear. I had to deflect her attention away from him for her own sake. Hazel shifted forward in her chair. We're going to the police. I'll back up your story and we'll get him arrested and carted off to jail. He deserves no less. God, no. That was a terrible idea for dozens of reasons, none of which I could share with Hazel. You can't. I won't. She pulled back. Incredulous, eyes wide. Why not? Are you that scared of him? She watched me as I tried not to squirm. What's going on? Is there something you're not telling me? I struggled to figure out how to answer. I love him. I don't think I've hated myself as much as I did when I said those three words. Hazel shook her head, confused. If he hits you, why would you love him? I waited a moment, trying to figure out how to derail her demand to go to the police. Just leave it alone, that's all. I'm fine. If you've never been in a long-term relationship, you wouldn't know what it's really like. She inhaled sharply. The concern on her face was replaced with a stunned bewilderment. I see. I'm not sure who you are anymore, Maxine. I wondered that myself. Look, give me some time, okay? I promise everything will be fine. I just can't be pushed right now, after the bad reviews and now this. I need a little time to get my bearings. Reassess everything. You can understand that, can't you? She nodded, but I could practically see her mind spinning, trying to figure out what I'd left unsaid, where the missing pieces of the puzzle lay. Look, I'm sorry. I spoke out of turn. You and Charlie. I know you're close. I just worry about it, that's all.
Hazel's face grew pinched. After opening night, he told me that he'd been accepted into the FBI, and we had a terrible row. I told him to break off from his father, from all the spy hunting, right there and then. He refused, and that was that. We're done.
I took a sip of my drink, unable to meet her eye or offer a word of comfort. Relief poured over me. They were done. She'd gone and saved herself without knowing it. I'd meet with Arthur tomorrow first thing and tell him that Charlie and Hazel were no longer a couple and to go jump in a lake. Hazel was safe. That was my main concern. Whatever awfulness she'd gone through, I wouldn't be adding to her woes any further. Not as long as she and Charlie stayed apart. I took a deep breath, spoke in a soothing tone. I'm so sorry. That must be difficult. But I think you did the right thing. I thought I'd be enough for him to let his family's legacy go, for the sake of us. He's a guy with a chip on his shoulder and something to prove to the world, to his father. You wait. You'll meet someone smart and lovely and see Charlie for what he really is. What's that? A boy. He's not a man. You deserve a man. We both do. She considered that for a moment. I worried I was being too pushy. I think you're right. Thank you, Max. She reached out and put her hand over mine. I don't know what I would have done without you, through all this. Guilt tugged at me, hard. I ought to confess everything, get it all out. But I could already imagine how her features would rearrange themselves, grow hard and cold, and then my best friend would be lost to me forever. The roof door opened and Lavinia appeared, holding an empty wine bottle in one hand and a glass in the other. Her hair, normally up in a bun at the nape of her neck, hung in loose strands down her back, and the colorful caftan she wore had slipped to one side, revealing a bare, bony shoulder.
Girls! My girls!
She settled into one of the chairs and poured the last few drops of wine from the bottle into her glass.
Don't worry, I've sent one of the porters out to the liquor store. The perks of hotel living.
Lavinia, are you drunk? Asked Hazel.
I'm smashed to pieces, my dear. Don't mind me.
She sat back in her chair, looking up at the sky.
What a view. I'll never get tired of this view.
Hazel and I exchanged looks.
Oh, before